Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And you're more than welcome to initiate and organize your own appeal to heaven. But if you would like to join one, we already have Loudoun Liberty up there. We don't have any others. So if you're looking to have, and I know there's a lot of people out there that, you know, organize prayer circles. So if you would like to be listed and actually have one that's where you want to, you know, have patriots join you in prayer, it's, I don't know if it's just, you know, embarrassing. I don't get it. Why, you know, we don't have other people calling and contacting us other than the fact that, I don't know, they just don't want to be outed. But I do understand why I don't have. When I actually had a live show, and I, for the first year plus, I had a live show, and very rarely got anybody to phone call. I mean, I got a few phone calls, say, hey, I love what you're doing. But nobody wanted to talk about the Constitution. And so I can only attribute that to where, you know, people just feel they don't understand. If you don't understand something enough, you don't say anything because you don't want to look stupid. And I honestly think that we need to change that paradigm. We need to actually say it's okay to look stupid if you're trying to learn. It's okay to miss the target. I mean, if you went target practicing with your rifle or handgun and you just first bought it, you're learning for the first time, do you not go out there because you don't want to look stupid because you're going to miss the target? No. So anyway, if you have comments, if you've got feedback, got some feedback this past week from a Carol in Arizona specifically, asking for some, and it wasn't really something to talk about that worth talking. I just don't want to say it that way. It was more of where do you have this information? So I will respond, folks. I've yet to have anybody out me because I reached out to you other than it happened once. And it was a long time ago. I actually found the phone number. I called the person. I said, I'm so sorry. I'm just getting back to you. But at that point in time, I had some medical issues as a good excuse. But anyway, let me kind of move forward. One more thing that I haven't said is your campaign begins now. Quit wasting time. You've got little less than 2 years to go on the attack against these people who are not willing to support the Constitution. Now, I'm thinking and hoping that maybe I'll have some conversations with some people that actually have, you know, this legitimate, let's call them perennial candidates. And I think we might be having one where we'll have a mutual interview conversation regarding campaigns. And so I honestly believe that you get better results if you build a movement, but it takes effort. It takes people getting out there and contributing. And so eventually you get to a point where all of a sudden everybody just points to you as the authority. And, I mean, they just realize that this person's never wrong on what they're doing. You know, that's our source. That's our local source of what's right, what's wrong regarding the Constitution. And if you make your campaign on the Constitution, you will win. Because everybody has this fundamental understanding of how important the Constitution is. Now, I do need to make a couple of clarifications. In other words, I have to, you know, repent for some sins and some woes that I've created upon myself. But before I do that, I wanted to let you know this Thursday will not be a content, quote unquote, air quotes here, a content show per se, we're going to have content, and what we're going to do is we're going to play some of Chip Murray's music. And so we're going to have an interview with Chip, and we're actually going to go dive into a few of his songs. The songs that I think, these are really good songs. These are songs that are worthy of playing with your kids hearing and so forth. The words are nothing to be ashamed of, and the music is actually really well. Really good musicianship, a good quality sound. And so what I want to do is I'm introducing people and companies. So we're going to end up having Timber Nation back on because I've already had the conversation with Timber Nation, and they're willing to actually help contribute to people who have, help me out here, who have signed the petition that they will step down if, and at heart's notice, if they violate their oath in any way. If it has been brought forward in a First Amendment petition and well articulated as to how they violated their oath, then they'll step down. Now, I think we as people need to have a little bit of, I'll just say, a little pause when we go after somebody, because I think in that First Amendment petition, if they redress the grievances, because it's something that was either a nuance, lack of understanding, we can't. You hear me say, I think last week I said sometime, that we have to stop this scorched earth attitude with regards to how people are acting. I mean, it's one thing when a person is consistent and they are, let's just say, they are deeply entrenched in an attack on the Constitution. So we're going to talk about that because those people seriously need to have their citizenship revoked. Now, whether that's permanently revoked or what, but we need to actually start revoking. You know, folks, we would not be in this situation of a democracy if we were actually enforcing the Constitution. Because people who are voting for Democrats and voting for unconstitutional government, they should actually have a pause on their citizenship to say, look, you can't be voting for this stuff. Doesn't matter if you want to. Your right to vote, your right to act as a citizen, you need to be supporting the Constitution. If you're supporting unconstitutional things, unconstitutional, the Democratic Party, anybody that votes Democrat should lose their citizenship. If there's a kin and tie directly to the violation of the Constitution, and you're voting for somebody that says, I'm willing to do that, I don't care, you know, whether it's unconstitutional or not, we have a right to violate the Constitution. Actually, you don't. Every citizen is basically legally bound by that oath, whether you're born under that oath or whether you actually had to take that oath to become a citizen. That oath implies that you can and will be called upon and forced, compelled to take up arms to support that Constitution. Any person that is not willing to do that, or any person that's openly and out there literally violating their oath or this concept of supporting the Constitution, we can't trust you anymore. Therefore, you're not going to be a part of our militia. Therefore, you don't have the right to bear arms. You don't have the right and the privileges and immunities that are guaranteed by this Constitution. This is why I constantly tell people how important it is. If you're going to go down that sovereign citizenship movement, you better really, really need it, because you should no longer be voting. You should no longer have any protections. Due process, the Privileges and Immunities Clause, do not apply to you. It's very clear right there that they delineated it as they as they amended the Constitution. They clarified that these things extend to citizens of the United States. Even though they have perverted that government, the Constitution has not been perverted. They have created a perverted Constitution and are abiding by that. But that doesn't mean that the original Constitution is illegitimate. It means that they've convinced everybody else to follow their abomination. We got to quit accepting the lie. If you're accepting the lie and you're going down this jural assembly, you're going down these different tracks of setting up shadow governments making communications with The Hague. That right there is setting up a shadow government. You have no authority as a U.S. citizen to communicate to foreign entities regarding governance. That is the job of our representatives and the government itself. Even though they're violating it, it is your job and duty to use the First Amendment petition to demand redress and to start educating your fellow citizens that we have, the supreme law of the land demands that they be held accountable. Okay, so I've gone down this long rat hole. Bottom line, I've got a couple of things I need to clarify before I dive into my dialogue regarding what a constitutional presidency for Donald Trump could actually do. And we're going to tie some things that we've already covered together in this concept, because it's kind of a revisit of something that kind of came up to be a real conversation that I have not had on the air. So the first clarification, and I know either Friday, or maybe it was Monday, I started and I blurted out that corporations are government entities. Technically, by the origins of the company, they are. Even though they may be privately owned, invested, in other words, there's no government money going in to establish that entity. There's a group of people that said, we want to organize, we want to, regulate labor, we want to have all of these things that we want to do. So that means that they're registering with the state and they have to abide by the state and the laws of the state. They cannot enforce laws that are unconstitutional. Therefore, technically, they are government entities. They're registered entities with the government, even though they're privately invested and operating in what we call the private sector. So don't confuse this. There's nobody that can go and operate other than families. You can have a family business that, because as a family, you are a business. You do not have to register with the state to function and operate because you are considered, let's just say, you have an inalienable right to conduct commerce as a family. That means you can grow crops and you can sell things and so forth as a family. Now, if you're, and we're talking about just openly selling to people. Now, if you're going to enter into selling into a, let's call it, what do you want to call it, an exchange or a commodities exchange and or a repository where you basically put your food, like let's say you're growing grain, and it goes into, this grain exchange, and they pay you for all of your grain. That right there is a commercial or business-to-business, and business-to-business would be taxed. But technically, you shouldn't be taxed if you're selling something to a private entity. In other words, you have a fruit stand on the side of the road, or you operate a fruit stand, there should be no taxes on that. That's a person-to-person transaction. You're not functioning as an organized business to an organized business. You are a family business to family business. And those family businesses cannot be fettered by government. Government cannot regulate families. It was entailed and understood in the days of the framers. And one of the reasons why they had such large families, and one of the reasons why they never named their children when they were born because of infantile, the infantile survival rate was so high. In other words, there was a good percentage of kids that would die after they were being born. Just died, crib death, what have you. And so they got to a point where it just became the custom in America. I know that in the Adams family, they referred to the new child as the visitor. They wouldn't even name the child until they got to the age of two. Isn't that interesting? So the reason why families had large, large families or parents had a lot of children was due to the fact that they needed help doing the family business. And then as the children would grow up, they would extend and kind of create, just like the plantations were creating franchises, but they were actually commercial entities because they were operating from with a business-to-business model. A lot of families just basically did, you know, exchanges and those types of transactions. They may go down to a grocery store or what the general store and sell, you know, or give and put it on consignment. However that was done, that wasn't really considered a business-to-business commodities where your grain is going to go and maybe shipped around the world into these commodity exchanges. But anyway, the point is this, is that yes, all corporations, all businesses that have to be registered with the state are technically government entities. Just like an NGO is a government entity, a nonprofit is a government entity. It is registered with the government and is being regulated by the government that it has to do these very specific things. Therefore, when you look at the constitutionality of these corporations trying to inflict or pass laws or do things that violate your rights as citizens, such as licensing agreements and those types of things you have to sign, most of the stuff that they require of you is unconstitutional. And the state is literally letting them get away with this, because the state doesn't consider them a government entity. They don't consider them. They will regulate them over their commerce. But when it comes down to the 14th Amendment, no state can make or enforce any law or allow any law to be enforced within their state that violates the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen. Now, I may have added that. All I'm doing is twisting it. They're not to enforce it. If corporations come around, and what would end up happening if you violated a Microsoft software licensing agreement? They would have to actually go to the state to get that enforced. And right there, even though you may have signed an agreement, if you violate that because they are violating your rights, then they're the ones at fault. Because no entity can be organized and actually violate your rights and operate without being punished and or being, I'll just say, dismantled by the government. So if Walmart, if a company that you go to a company, you know, small business, Verizon store, and you decide that you want to have a First Amendment petition rally, not a big one, just over in a couple parking spaces, but it's a big parking lot, and you're not taking up any room so that people, hey, I can't park because those guys are over there. In other words, you're being non-intrusive. I mean, in other words, the Verizon store has a right to commit commerce. In other words, they have this right to be open and do their business. So whenever you block their access or you get on the sidewalk and so forth, like the way people did with abortion clinics, and that's a completely different issue, and I don't want to dive into that because that's just another rat hole to go into. Let me focus on this, that if you're doing First Amendment petitions, then you have a right to be there. You're exercising your right as a citizen in public space. How is it public? Because that's private land, supposedly? No, it's not. It's a company operating within your state. They bought that land to operate on. Even though they may own that land has been designated as open for the public. If it is private land, then they have to basically articulate, this is private property, and only if they say anybody can come here, anybody can come here, then anybody can come there. They cannot create a rule that says no initiatives, no petitioning, no organizing. They cannot do that. They can do that if they literally deny most people and have a subset of the public. In other words, a member club, a membership club, you know, like a golf club. The only way you can get access in there is because you are a member, which means that they literally do have a fence and a gate guard, and they control access. In other words, they're not open for the public. So the point is that these corporations, you may not think that they are, and we've actually bought off and can, and and somehow we've just swallowed this. I don't say agreed, but somehow we've just swallowed this idea that these are private entities. They're really not. Your family business is a private entity. Families are private. Families are protected. Business cannot regulate your family. But if you're going to be going into business and doing, you know, commodity exchanges or what have you, and dealing with business to business and open for the public to come and buy from you and so forth, then you literally become a government entity that has to comply with the constitutional requirements in protecting the citizens of that state, period. And they don't do this. Nobody does this because everybody thinks it's okay to allow these private, supposedly private corporations to violate your rights and actually sell your data and and do all sorts of things. Let me get into one other thing. So I also talked about, because this came up as well as a little bit of feedback, I talked about, you know, and I kind of picked on Eric Clapton for, you know, the way he's gripes, moans, and there's lots of them to do this. I just picked on him because he's popped up in the news as, you know, really wanting to enforce permanent copyrights. Not in America, sorry. You want to sell your stuff in America, then, you know, you have to abide by our copyright laws. Now, corporations, and I should say corporations, entities, you know, there's this group of elitists that have convinced / forbidden most consumer electronics today from being able to make copies. Now, there once was a day when you had a video cassette recorder that you could actually go buy a video cassette recorder and make copies of the video cassette. And then they started creating these copyright labels or copyright headers on the thing so that if it scanned it, it would not allow the copy to be performed. And so they've gone and used electronics and so forth so that they could go out of their way in protecting what they were referring to, these permanent copyrights. Oh, we've put a copyright on that and that's it. No. And as a matter of fact, I already mentioned this, that the Supreme Court has clearly stated, you buy that, you have access to it, it is on the airways, public, it's in the public airways, public domain, it's on the internet, and or you can actually go and you buy that, you have a copy of it, you can make your own copy. That's it. You can have your own copies as long as you are not selling those copies and making money in becoming an entrepreneur. You know, that used to be a huge business. And this is why they really, you know, I'll just say they kind of hardened their stance and they basically, you know, put this position out there that we're going to go after everybody that is copywriting or whatever they call it. I forget what they called it. But bootleg. That was the term. Bootleg records, bootleg videos, bootleg, because they were literally violating copyrights and selling them. Now, kind of interesting, there are some artists that actually have a series of bootleg albums. In other words, Johnny Winter, I forget, he's got a lot. He's dead now, but he's a blues guitarist. And, you know, there were just so many different bootlegs of him because he just was, he was a performer. He didn't do a lot of studio work, but he did a lot of performing. And so over time, there was so many people out there doing bootlegs, he actually started creating his own so that everybody could buy his bootlegs. And so wherever he went and whenever he performed, he tried to capture on that tour or whatever, you know, those performances so that people would have a legitimate copy from him. Because technically, if you have to pay access to get into that, that's not considered public air or what have you. So they do have a right to protect that information. But the question is, how long can they protect, you know, the data with their imagery, the video, the music, that level of content that they're creating live? How long can they actually protect that? And Congress has got this way out of hand because they're allowing permanent copyrights. And the Constitution doesn't allow that. So when we get back, we're going to actually focus then on Trump and the finances. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me get to the Trump presidency, or what a constitutional Trump presidency would really look like. I mean, if Trump was, he's taking an oath. If he was really going to be supporting the Constitution, folks, there would be probably real death threats on his life, because he would be changing life the way, I'm just going back to what I just said earlier about citizens wanting to violate their oath, and they're out in the open. This is why it's really important that we actually start identifying and deporting people that demand their right to actually violate and change our government. They don't. They do not. The law does not allow that. There are established laws, and anybody, we'll dive into all this. So, and as a matter of fact, the topic today is reducing the inflation of our currency and basically changing our economic position. Because you do realize it was sometime around World War I, World War II, where we became a very stable currency and we became the foundation of the global currency. In other words, everything was done to U.S. dollars. And so due to the fact that we've inflated it to such an extent that many nations, Russia and China specifically, are yet, you know, flapping their gums to say we need to actually get off the U.S. dollar. There's a reason why we want to have the U.S. dollar as the foundation, because it's a huge savings to us. But more importantly, it is a point, and I don't want to use the word pride, but it is a point, let's just say, of contention as to who has the most stable, who does the best job in managing their currency and their economics. Now, technically, the federal government cannot be regulating, you know, the production and the commerce and those types of things, but they can regulate foreign commerce coming in and commerce going out. But what we're going to cover today is going to kind of be, it's not an amalgamation, you know, a comprehensive, complete, you know, comprehensive grouping of everything that I've been talking about. It's more of a glumfry. It's kind of like a mix of things we've already covered, a mix of things, not everything. And so let me give you the list, because I've been covering this. The invasion, I'm not going to be touching that today. The currency, yes. The removal from the UN and subjugation and the treaties and so forth, kind of. An immediate appeal to the states, absolutely. The lockdown of the Department of Justice, absolutely. The retraction of staffing of the Department of Interior, specifically, not really. The state sovereignty and the abilities, yeah, absolutely. We'll be kind of covering that. So in other words, the things I've already covered, I'm going to be using those to kind of support what I'm going to be talking about today. Restoring impost taxes and disbanding foreign holdings and so forth, a little bit. Reconstituting our national security system, not really. The foreign affairs regarding our hemisphere, the Monroe Doctrine stuff, not really. But the constitutional state oversight over the intelligence community and that the overall oversight, yeah, kind of. But what we're going to be doing is how can we actually change our economic situation? And it is not a simple thing to talk about. So actually, having this conversation regarding a constitutional presidency is very difficult, because the difficulties lie in covering the details of a presidential plan to lead the efforts, what I would call leading the efforts of republic review, or restoring or reclaiming our republic, and restoring our constitutional, our hybrid constitutional republic to the specific and intricate functions of the government that that constitution dictates, specific and intricate. One must understand precisely how the Constitution was defined in the ratification debates, period, end of story, if we're going to do this. So the problem we face is that there are, interestingly enough, these factions that have clearly established themselves, in other words, deviations to the truth. These factions have clearly established themselves regarding what the Constitution means, and almost all of them are basing it upon the Federalist Papers. Progressive and conservative, is that not interesting? Now, they vary, because the conservatives believe that it's a fixed Constitution based on the Federalist Papers. However, based on the Federalist Papers, the progressives believe it's a living document, open to judicial interpretation. And interestingly enough, the conservatives accept judicial interpretation to an extent, but they still believe it's basically fixed. They don't believe in this living Constitution, redefining and so forth. Now, because these differences exist regarding the Federalist Papers, I can honestly see the significance and the importance of these papers, but we absolutely need to handle this, and we need to put this at rest, clearly. We need to finalize what is the truth and what is the source documents that we're going to use. So I can see why, and we've covered this over the past year, why James Madison emphasized the ratification debates in his congressional debates. I've gone out of my way pointing this out. And every opportunity that has arisen when people are trying to understand what to do, how to move forward, and so forth, Madison has gone out of his way to explain why we have to look at the Constitution as the way it was defined to the states at the time of ratification. In other words, he constantly had the ratification debates in his hands. What happened? Why is it that this is, nobody knows this, nobody understands this, or everybody's overlooking this? Because if you really want to boil it down, if you want to distill what our government should be, that's where you'll find the truth. And as a matter of fact, I have zero evidence that James Madison ever supported the Federalist Papers as the golden source of accurate understanding of the Constitution. That right there is an indictment. How is it that one of the authors of the Federalist Papers came right out and said, hey, those documents mean nothing? So when we even look at his letter, because we just recently read this, Tammy and I read this in December, where he actually responded to John G. Jackson, who was requesting a copy of the Constitutional Convention, his notes on the Constitutional Convention, so that they could understand the Constitution better. And I would say that it offers more insights and more detail to the Constitution than the Federalist Papers. Federalist Papers really dive in some theory, and these are just arguments, and they're worthless. They're insightfully worthless. How's that? Because I do not want to elevate them. I used to elevate them. And as a matter of fact, in my logo, I elevated them because I couldn't get the ratification debates as far as a published document, an image of a published document to inject into my logo. And so as we look at what is legally, what is the legal foundation of what we're supposed to be using in defining the Constitution? Contract law demands that when a question arises regarding the contract, that if terms and conditions exist, then they are the grounds, they're the grounds for the truth to how the contract was stipulated and must be followed. In other words, without saying as many words, if you make a contract with somebody and you stipulate very specific terms and conditions orally, you say, you're going to do this, and you cover all these things in an agreement, you shake hands, and then the person goes, that person gets started in doing the work you commissioned them to do, and they don't do what you basically stipulated, what you had them stipulate. And everybody knows this, if you have it written down, end of story, done. That's how it was stipulated. Therefore, are there any documents that clarify the stipulations of what those lines mean in the Constitution? Absolutely. Guess what documents those are, folks? No, they're not the Federalist Papers. As a matter of fact, the Federalist Papers are the farthest thing from that, because the Federalist Papers were just articles that were being published in the newspaper. The ratification debates are those articles. As a matter of fact, the notes on the Constitutional Convention is far more, has far more legal standing than the Federalist Papers. These were just editorials, a person's opinion. They made no weight. However, the ratification debates made almost all of the weight, if not all, and I'll say almost all, if not all, because there were points in the Constitutional Convention that created clear understanding. I'll give you a good point. The equal footing doctrine or the natural born citizen, those two points were very well understood by, you know, how it was defined by Vattel in the laws of nature, or not the laws of nature, in the laws of nations. The natural born citizen, that was clearly defined in the laws of nations, and it was a well accepted definition. The same thing regarding the equal footing doctrine. That was a doctrine that was adopted through the convention, and that became the prevailing doctrine, which is why when you read Section 3 of Article 4, there is no language in that article that allows the federal government to diminish the sovereignty of a state joining the Union. It only allows the federal government to create laws, necessary laws and regulations regarding the territory while it is in their stewardship. Once it becomes a state, it is state property, which actually became a huge problem when they were creating these Indian reservations, and those states actually became states, and they had an Indian reservation inside that state. And they said, oh, we're going to keep that. Article 4, Section 3 does not allow them to maintain any land within that. When that land is transitioned into a state, the responsibility goes to the state. And what the state should have done is the federal government should have tipped off, hey, you've got these good people in there, and you need to, you know, figure out how you want to transition them or what to do. And leave it up to the states and the Indian tribe or Indian tribes that are within the state. That never happened. And as a matter of fact, they were told carte blanche, hey, that's ours, we regulate that, you can't touch it. And everybody just accepted anything and everything the federal government was telling them. I mean, there were pushbacks, but bottom line, every time push came to shove, they would go in front of the court, and the court being a sycophant for the rest of the federal government, they absolutely supported almost everything that they were doing. Very rarely did the SCOTUS go and break away. Even recently, still when I look at these rulings, such as the overturning of Roe v. Wade, the overturning of the Chevron, these are not mind-boggling overturnings. They're not. They're not really identifying the fact that, hey, look, we have very limited jurisdiction. We shouldn't even be hearing. I would love to see SCOTUS become so honest that they could create a full list of all of the cases they ruled on that they had no jurisdiction to even make a ruling on. Wow, wouldn't that kind of honesty would be, it'd be divine. When people actually open up and they say, I have done you wrong, and this is how I've done it. Right? That's a divine repentance. When somebody says, I have done you wrong, and forgive me because I did this. You know, it's almost like, you know, would you forgive them, though? Yeah, but you want to make sure that, one, it wouldn't happen again, and you want to put things in place so it wouldn't happen again. Technically, we already have a pretty decent system within that Constitution. This is why one of the things I've been telling you is that the states need to start putting safeguards. They need to actually start having involvement and direct oversight over certain things. This is why Trump, as a part of his constitutional presidency, needs to be directly involved. But clearly, everybody listening understands that the fundamental tenets of contract law, if somebody stipulated that you would have this by, if you signed this contract, if you went into an agreement with them, they would give you this. And if they didn't give you that, they were legally binding, but you couldn't hold them to it if you didn't have it written down. There you go. The ratification debates were written down. Now, granted, there are some parts that were not copied or, you know, captured, because you'll find these points in the ratification debates where James Madison or somebody, whoever was talking, talked too soft that they couldn't make out what they were saying. So those words were omitted. I am okay with that. And I'm here to say I'm okay with that, because these men, as we look at the ratification debates, and as they basically stated that what the Federalists stated and stipulated that contract to mean, they were harmonious. There was no disagreement. There was nowhere where, you know, a couple of states said, no, this is a general contract, or these are general powers. The federal government can do anything and everything. And the state said, yay, that's great. We're going to let them do everything to us. That didn't happen, folks. Every turn and every time it was brought up, they were limited. They were defined, and this is exactly what it meant. This is why we go through these debates. We prove this to you, and I've been proving this to you since 2018, 2019, as we started reading these things. So, I'm just trying to lay the groundwork so that you really understand, you know, what a Trump presidency can do. And this is why having the judiciary actually changed. As a matter of fact, I said before that the Department of Justice, not the judiciary, the Department of Justice needed to just be retooled. But actually, I think it should be demoted into an office. And I think over time that office would shrink as states became a part of that Department of Justice, where they actually created their own. Why would they even need to create their own? Well, you've heard me say this. Let's just make a real quick reference to Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. When we look at a Republican form of government, when we look at how this nation was stood up and how this Republican form of government was defined, how it was clearly stipulated in forming that in a Republican and in this Republican form of government, our law or the Constitution for the United States of America is our king. We have no person that's a king. The law is our king. And therefore, our king has been amended, or the law has incorporated this concept of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. That means that absolutely has to be actualized in government and government agencies. How do we get there? Because I'm telling you, folks, we're out here fighting in the counties to get constitutional compliance. We actually have one county standing up a committee in Stevens County, Washington. We're trying to get this in Wyoming. I've had initial meetings with Gillette and Washgiga or something like that, a couple of counties in Wyoming. We're talking about having possibly other meetings. And the sooner the better. The more counties that actually start putting their shoulder into this and actually start pushing, and, you know, other people living in the county pulling, so that we get this push-pull working for us, we can get this concept of enforcing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. It is the law. All public servants have to abide by this. And therefore, and so here's a problem, because we get these soothsayers, we get these devil's advocates, we get journalists to say, well, it's never been enforced, so how are you going to enforce it? Well, we absolutely need to have a mechanism for we the people to enforce it. Because obviously, because it's been around for over 150 some years, and we've still yet to have it actualized in government where it's a part of the law and being enforced, we the people have to demand this. But a constitutional president can make it happen like that. A constitutional president would ensure that the Department of Justice be retooled into an office of justice and start actually going after all public servants. The focus should completely shift from the Department of Justice, from all of these things that they're doing in suing the states and everything else, and ending their warfare against the states and the people, and actually going and not, I don't want to say committing warfare, but I think that we're at the time where we need a Spanish Inquisition against our public servants. And I honestly believe that public servants are going to go, what do I need to know? What do I need to do? Because I don't want to be, I don't want to be one of those guys. You know, every once in a while, something really bad happens. And that kind of the person that did it becomes infamous because their name is associated with it, like gerrymandering. I remember when, and Everybody Loves Raymond, just to take a quick aside, because it came up in the conversation where Raymond actually recorded, they had a wedding video, him and Deborah had a wedding video, and he recorded over that, he recorded the Super Bowl over that. And he was in, he basically committed marital suicide. I mean, he was dead to Deborah. How do you get out of that? How do you fix that? And so that's what the show was about. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because when Raymond was confessing to his parents, his father, Frank, Peter Boyle, who, you know, had a good laugh and said, boy, that is, you know, that becomes the statement, well, at least I didn't pull a Raymond, you know, at least I didn't do a Jerry, you know, Jerry Eldridge, at least, you know, and this is how we think. We look at, we create the association of whoever did that, whoever was notoriously bad at doing that. Well, at least I didn't do that, right? Fact is this, is that we have this responsibility, and when we actually look at the Constitutional Compliance Committee at the county level, and we're trying to create it at the state level in Wyoming, this Department of Justice would be the ultimate, and they would make sure that there would be this process of, you know, holding people directly accountable. Now, does a government entity have the right to make a petition? Absolutely. Petitions can be done by, when we look at the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, those resolutions were sent to the other states, their fellow states, as petitions. They were petitioning them to join them. Even though it was said the resolutions, these weren't just, hey, this is what we're doing. These were very clear. Hey, we are now asking you to join us in this process of holding the government accountable. So can the department or the Office of Justice actually petition? Absolutely they can. State legislatures can. Technically, when you have a Constitutional Compliance Committee, they can write petitions to actually send directly to who they report to. And as a matter of fact, at the federal government, there's no reason why they can't actually send it out to the states to say, hey, you know, you got a problem down in this county because these guys are going crazy, or, you know, they're running roughshod over the Constitution. We can't allow that to happen. You need to pull them in or we will, because this constitutional compliance needs to be integrated. See, my hat's off to Bob Schultz, because Bob Schultz wanted to create an independent entity to do this. But I believe, and I believe that this should be actually manned by citizens. But I think at the federal level, this is where, you know, once Once we obtain common knowledge of what the Constitution really means, in other words, once these counties actually definitize the Constitution, then that will actually propagate and that will become the common knowledge. In other words, this document that actually has the entire bibliography of every definition from the ratification debates regarding every line. That's the whole point, is to create that definitive clarity as to what every line means. Therefore, as it moves forward, when somebody comes along, it's in the case where a case actually covers a clause in the Constitution where people go, well, how was that defined? If there's really no definitions provided for it, it doesn't mean that the court has the ability to interpret. No, they don't. They then have to, at the Supreme Court level, they have to go and tell Congress, hey, Congress, you need to get the state legislatures to define this. And ergo, it would go out to the states because Congress can't even define something to be constitutional. Only those things that have been given them the charge to do so. So as we look at, you know, because the congressional districts were made up by Congress based on the census. So they had that ability to do certain things. But they can't, if it's in the Constitution and they don't have a hard definition, it's got to go to the states because they are the parties to the compact, not the federal government. Now, the natural born citizen was something that was absolutely done with, and they used common knowledge, or not common knowledge. I'm sorry. It was common knowledge that they applied in creating the definitions, which is why not one state pushed back on what a natural born citizen was. Not one state. They looked at it and go, yep, thumbs up. That's good. Love it. And that's how they move forward. So when we start looking at this financing and so forth, I didn't even dive into it. I didn't even really dive into what we need to do to basically stabilize our currency. But inflation and dealing directly with inflation is one of those things that has to be done. So what we really want to do when we come back, because I've got barely a minute left, when we come back on Friday, I'm going to dive into, because I'm not going to cover all the stuff I just covered. If I kept on repeating everything, I'd never get anything done. So when we start off on Friday, we're really going to be diving into what Trump needs to do and how he reduces the currency in circulation and how he starts transitioning the currency to gold, because it's all related. See, we look at the need, but I didn't address the inflation. That is another problem. We have to bring back the value of the dollar and make it commutable as well. And so we have to kind of figure this out. How to do that. And there is merit in actually creating, because unfortunately we've devalued the currency to a point to where a dollar, you know, or I should say $100, or I should say $50, is basically what a $20 used to be maybe 10, 15 years ago. And, you know, $100 is probably what a $20 bill used to be back in the 70s. If you look at the buying power of money today, because of inflation. So we're going to talk about this, of what and how this has to be done or should be done per the Constitution and what Trump could literally do. So when we come back on Friday, we'll address this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.